We'll hear argument next in case 07474, Enquist versus Oregon Department of Agriculture. Mr. Katyal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The Ninth Circuit held that no discrimination against a public employee is prohibited by the Equal Protection Clause unless the targeted person is a member of a suspect class or exercises a fundamental right. No matter how outrageous or evil, and no matter how unrelated to any legitimate government interest, the clause provides zero protection. This theory is contrary to the Constitution's text. It is inconsistent with this Court's precedents. It is unworkable, and it is unnecessary. The Ninth Circuit ignored the Equal Protection Clause's guarantee to any person that the state will not use its vast powers to discriminate without a legitimate government purpose, and particularly not in ways that lead to inefficient government. This Court has articulated three principles that control this case. First, the Constitution protects the individual from irrational discrimination. Second, the 14th Amendment applies to public employers, and rational basis review applies to public employment. And third, the clause applies to the administrative actions of state officials, not just legislatures.
Well, rational basis review normally doesn't inquire into the actual motive, for example, of the state legislators who impose such a tax or impose such a restriction. We simply ask, could there have been a rational basis for this? Now, are you willing to abide by that test?
We are, Your Honor. The Ninth Circuit below said no rational basis test ever. And indeed, the trial in this case allowed the government to articulate any rationale, conceivable or not. We do think, even though it doesn't
Listen to what I'm saying. Not whether you could decide that given all of the facts of this case, the criticism of the co-workers and all of that, whether it is conceivable to say that this was done on a rational basis. That isn't the rational basis test. It's just sitting back without these factual inquiries, just as we don't inquire factually into why the state legislature acted, just asking, could there have been a rational basis for the dismissal of this employee?
Your Honor, we do agree that that last part, Justice Scalia, looking at could there have been a rational basis is the proper test. But that is a factual determination at some level. That is, this Court in Kimmel and a variety of other cases have said that you still have to look to the underlying facts. And even the Solicitor General doesn't disagree at page 5 of their brief when they say you have to look to whether the, whatever that rationale is supported by the record. The government had the opportunity.
So that what you do in this case, I mean, the person is fired. And that's all you know. And so you go back and see, well, is there any possible reason? So you look at the timesheets and, oh, here are a few days where she punched in late. That's a possible reason. And that's enough.
Well, we do think that that can be enough. And indeed, that's what the government had their opportunity to argue in this case. The Ninth Circuit, of course, thought even that very deferential inquiry off altogether. Now,
and so in that case, and then let's say you're at trial and you ask him, did you fire this person because she punched in late a few times? I take it the objection would be that that's irrelevant and that would be sustained.
Well, if it is a counterfactual, I mean, the plaintiff would have the opportunity to negate the facts on whatever that rationale.
No, the records show she was a few times she punched in late.
And if it has anything to do with government efficiency, the rational basis test is that deferential to permit that to go forward.
What about he didn't like it? I'm the supervisor. I didn't like it.
And even that, Justice Breyer, is enough so long as it's related to government efficiency. That is,
well, all right, now you say related to government. If the truth is, I don't like this person, goodbye. Now, is that rational? When you say, I mean, you know as much about the case now as I do. Not this case, but, you know, that's all we know. Is that rational or not?
That by itself is not, because it doesn't have anything
to do. Now, that seems to me to be the problem, that either, going back to Justice Scalia's point, you're either going to say rational in these circumstances, which means you go into it whether the timesheet was this or whether it was that or the other, or you say, hey, it's always rational because you could have fired him because you don't like the person. That's and I don't see some intermediate step there. To put the question differently, every government has a state and federal has an Administrative Procedures Act. That forbids unreasonable, arbitrary action. Why do they need that if the Constitution does it by itself?
Okay. Let me say two things, because there are two different questions there. One has to do with the state laws and so on. And this Court has never said that the existence of other state remedies somehow displaces the Equal Protection Clause or other constitutional guarantees.
What about on the federal level? Could a federal employee who says just what was alleged here come right into court and bring a Bivens action and says, I was discriminated against, and similarly situated people were not, and it was irrational? Could a federal employee come to court with such a complaint?
The answer is no, Justice Ginsburg, and the reason is at footnote 18 of our brief, and I believe the Solicitor General doesn't disagree in large amount. That is that for Bivens, the question will the court imply a right of action as opposed to the issue in this case, which is Section 1983, there is a statutory right of action already in existence.
And it doesn't matter that the state has civil service remedies that weren't used, or there are union grievance procedures that aren't used. You can go right into federal court and say, I don't have to use those state remedies.
That is correct. The existence of those state remedies does not displace or by itself without Congress coming in and mandating exhaustion or something like that. But in the absence of that, this Court has not said, outside of the limited area of procedural due process, that the existence of either collective bargaining agreements or state laws somehow displaces a federal constitutional guarantee. Now, if I can return to the first part of Justice Breyer's question, which was the dividing line and whether there's a clear standard, let me articulate this as one. We believe that when a government employer comes in and asserts some sort of objective reality, for here they said the wheat prices are declining, the plaintiff should have a chance to negate that and say, well, it turned out that actually the wheat prices weren't declining and so on. If, however, the government articulates the rationale that you had put forth before, I don't like you, and somehow the supervisor says it's interfering with my government efficiency and I can't do the job. Well, that's something that the employee will never be able to negate. And that is set forth in our reply brief at page 16.
Well, I guess you begin with the proposition that the government must always have a reason for what it does.
The government must always have a reason when it discriminates against individuals.
Well,
that
but
is the way
discrimination, when you say discrimination, I take it you're meaning discrimination not confined to the discrete categories of racial, age, etc. You're talking about discrimination for any purpose. And therefore, it seems to me that when you say the government cannot discriminate, I think, in effect, you're saying a government supervisor cannot fire somebody simply because he does not like that person, because that's a discrimination in relation to the people that the supervisor does like. Is that correct?
That is correct, as long as, Justice Souter, it is not related to government efficiency. That is, if it's like this case.
Right.
In which
it's not government efficiency. Exactly. I just don't want to be around this person.
Exactly.
Then it is the case, then, that if you prevail in this case, that the notion of paradigmatic at-will employment within the government in any state that recognizes that now, that will in fact be eliminated to the degree that there is a class of one cause of action.
To the contrary, Justice Souter, I don't think that will happen, and indeed has not happened, and there's not
any. Well, I thought you just agreed that it would happen in the hypothetical, because maybe I do not understand at-will employment, but I thought the concept of at-will employment was that the individual could be fired for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason at all. Somewhere in that trinity, we get Justice Breyer's hypothetical. I don't like him. And you're saying that won't pass muster, but it would pass muster under an at-will employment rule.
Justice Souter, as a practical matter, it won't matter. As a practical matter, it won't make a difference. And the reason is that because an employer can articulate, I don't like you, and it's undermining government efficiency, in most cases, particularly in at-will cases, where there isn't a collective bargaining agreement or state law that will constrain the ability of the employer to even articulate some sort of efficiency.
No. I'm not working with this person. It's not going to affect my efficiency. He's under somebody below me, but I just don't like him.
And if there isn't an efficiency and the state can't articulate a deficiency-based rationale, there will be some effect on at-will employment in those rare cases.
So you have a national for-cause employment system. You can only be fired for cause.
Well, except that the cause that that the Equal Protection mandates, the Equal Protection Clause's guarantee, is so deferential that, as Justice Breyer said, virtually any rationale will suffice if it is.
But you're getting back to the point: the government must always have a reason for what it does. Can you cite me a case that says that?
That the government must always have
a reason. Always have a reason for the actions it takes.
Well, I read this court's decision in OLEC as basically mandating that, as well as its, you know, as well as its long history on a class of one, starting with Sioux City, and Sunday Lake, and Snowden versus.
Yes, those are all tax cases, or in OLEC, 30 feet as opposed to 15 feet, where there was a clear difference that was not sustained, but there was also an allegation of some invidious motive.
And here, of course, the jury found that invidious motive. So even if we were to
Hard for me to get that sweeping proposition out of OLEC.
If the court were worried about at-will employment, it has available to it the possibility of requiring animus, just as Justice Kennedy, you're positing.
Well, what happens in this situation? The government gives a reason for whatever the adverse action is. And let's say it's a person had lower performance ratings than another person who was retained or given the promotion. Your position is the employee can always contest that and say that's not the real reason, that's not factually supported. Is that correct?
If the government articulates a rationale that is objectively based, budget or something like that, yes, the plaintiff can come back and try and rebut it. Now, it does so under the extremely deferential rational basis test, which is why so few causes get through. And indeed,
how is it extremely deferential? The employee is going to say that's not the real reason. The real reason was simply spite and animus and personal dislike.
Because if the government can put
forth — And that goes to the jury.
I don't believe it goes to the jury, Justice Alito, because under this Court's decision in Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, the summary judgment stage will incorporate whatever the rational basis test of review is.
The employee says in an affidavit, the supervisor doesn't like me, and here are — the 20 things that the supervisor has done and said over the course of the last 5 years to indicate personal dislike. Then it goes to the jury.
Again, as long as the employer can articulate a reason based on government efficiency, there is no way for that employee to rebut that.
But he's going to have to articulate it in federal court. You emphasize it's a deferential standard. It's not going to be it. But every case now, every case of an employee firing, in fact, every case of an employee not getting as big a raise as he thought he was entitled, that's now a federal case.
Well, there are two problems with that. First is those are already federal cases under existing laws, Title VII, the panoply of other laws.
Title VII, there's no, you know, it's because you don't like me. It's not because I'm a particular race.
But if we're positing a frequent filer plaintiff who's bent on trying to file a lawsuit, they can always make a Title VII. They can say, you're firing me because
I'm not worried about a frequent filer. I'm worried about 40 million single filers.
And the empirical evidence, Chief Justice, Mr. Chief Justice, is that that doesn't happen. And we've had this cause of action now for 26 and 27 years in two circuits. It's now the law of the land in nine circuits. We haven't had that entire flood, nor have we had the harm to at-will employment. And the reason is that plaintiffs aren't going to bring these causes of action when they know they're so hard to win.
That's why I started this. I read through, at least briefly, the circuit cases in this area. I was trying to figure it out. And it seemed to me that those circuit cases just really are finding some reason to dismiss the employee's claim, that they're not taking this seriously. I don't want to criticize them because I don't know the facts of the case. But I couldn't figure out a standard. And then I thought, well, the standard has to be the APA standard. And if it's, I know that standard. Mm-hmm. And the reason that you don't have a million cases under that standard is because states have civil service systems. So it seemed to me that's the standard you want to apply. You want to bring all those cases into federal court. And I'm not sure they're doing it now, really, in practice. Now, what's wrong with what I've just said?
Well, I don't think there's anything quite wrong with that. I'd say two things. One, the existence of all of those state remedies and so on are far more attractive for the employment plaintiff than this cause of action. And so that's one reason why you see these low numbers. Second is, I don't quite agree with you that the lower courts are, you know, maybe not taking it seriously or however. They have a long-established body of law now on how to dismiss these cases on 12b-6 motions, and the majority of the circuits have already held that because of the similarly situated requirement and intentionality requirements, as well as on summary judgment. That is because the test is so deferential.
But let's take this case. So you say there were 30 similarly situated people with regard to this employee being let go. Wouldn't that be a contested matter? The employer will say, they're not similarly situated. Each of them is differently situated. How does that get resolved on summary judgment?
Well, normally, it depends on the rationale that's being offered. Here, the government's rationale was declining wheat revenues. And so each of the employees who was paid out of those wheat revenues is similarly situated. The government in this case disclaimed the other rationales, performance, and so on. In the ordinary case,
I thought they withdrew from saying that it was a budgetary matter.
Well, there are two different budgetary issues. One was the budget having to do with the Oregon state budget. And that was ultimately withdrawn by the state. The other was that Ms. Enquist and 10 other or so employees were being paid out of wheat revenues. And the state's rationale at trial was that the wheat market was collapsing, and so they couldn't pay for Ms. Enquist anymore. And she was, of course —
Suppose the government comes in and says, we don't want to take a position as to what the reason was. It could have been any one of the following seven. You know, the wheat market collapsed. She came in late 5 days. Some of the jobs she didn't do well. She dressed inappropriately on the job. Her coworkers didn't like her. You know, and can the government do that?
The government can offer
those
as well.
Pick a reason? Does it have to pick a reason?
Absolutely not. It can pick
many
reasons.
So long as there's a conceivable reason, the court would grant summary judgment.
We think that's right. Now, there are —
I thought you did not agree with that in your brief. You said no hypothetical justification. It's not like legislation where any conceivable basis, even if the legislature didn't conceive it. I thought you were quite clear in saying, no, that's not what rational basis means in this context.
I might have misunderstood Justice Scalia's question. I thought he was saying, can the government put forth a conceivable rationale grounded in some fact? And the answer to that is yes. It's got to be grounded in fact.
Test. Well, all those facts are true facts. But the government isn't claiming that any one of them was the reason. It just says, here are the conceivable reasons why she might have been fired. We really don't know which one it was.
The plaintiff,
but here are seven perfectly conceivable reasons.
The government has the ability to put that forth, and the plaintiff has the ability to negate that. That is the rational basis test under this
What do you mean to negate it? To negate it as the actual reason is what you mean.
But
the government is not purporting to say that it's the actual reason.
Justice,
the government is saying, had she been dismissed for this reason, and we really don't know whether that was the reason or not, but had she been dismissed for this reason, it would have been rational.
So long as, Justice Scalia, that rationale is itself grounded in the facts. That is, you can't come in and say she was coming to work late when she wasn't. But if she were, then
— Well, I didn't understand your position to be that.
The test I'm trying to offer is one of objective — whether the rationale is objectively falsifiable.
Can I ask you a more abstract question about this class of one? Doesn't that have the effect of adding an equal protection claim to every violation of law? In other words, you have a Fourth Amendment search and seizure claim, and you're treated illegally. You say, well, everybody else was treated legally, and I wasn't, so it's an equal protection violation. You get, the zoning ordinance. It was improper under the zoning law, and because everybody else was properly treated, it's a violation of equal protection.
Right. That is a problem, I think, under this Court's decision in OLEC generally. It infects class of one.
Do you think OLEC was wrongly decided?
I do not. I think that this Court has had a long history on
but
OLEC.
I don't find anything in OLEC that says that every action that does not have a reason is constitutionally infirm.
Let me go back to Justice Kennedy to answer your question more directly. This Court has held in the employment case, in the employment context, that the government must have a rational basis. It said so in Hera versus Martin, Beezer, and Mergia, all of which say that when an employer is dismissing employees, it must act with a rational basis. So this
all
Court's already crossed that.
All of
that
those control. Involved a group characteristic. One involved people, Beezer wasn't it methadone users, but none of them involved a situation like this where she's not claiming anything about being a member of any identifiable class. She's just saying they discriminated against me, not because of sex, race, or anything else. They were out to get me.
Justice Ginsburg, I don't quite think that describes the facts of Hera versus Martin, in which it was a challenge to an individual termination decision by the school board. But I do agree the other cases are group-based characteristics. We don't think that makes a difference, and indeed, we think that the Solicitor General's test on this would be unworkable in practice, because everyone can assert their membership in some objective
group. No, but you could take that. I thought you could break the cases for the most part, into two parts. One, what Justice Ginsburg said, and that's where the real reason is some kind of general characteristic of a disfavored group. The second is the instance where the body that's acting is a body whose business it is to classify. That's zoning, taxation, and it means really classifying, in fact, not some theoretical thing where you say, oh, well, they're classifying in employment because you put you in the class of such and such. But those two seem to me to handle the bulk of the cases, which, if I'm right about that, would leave your client out in the cold. So I assume you'll tell me why I'm not right.
I will try. So the first thing is that I don't quite think that describes the facts of Hera versus Martin, which is an individual decision. And secondly, once you start going down the line of objective group-based characteristics and the like, it is infinitely manipulable, and that's why the Ninth Circuit decisions after, in the wake of this decision below, are dismissing group-based claims on disability and age and the like. Everyone can replead their claim as part of a group. That is, Ms. Enquist can say she's part of a group of two, those who complained about their supervisors and up the chain of command. And so the problem is it becomes unworkable in practice. And, of course, the Constitution, Justice Ginsburg, doesn't say the way the Solicitor General would like it to be, doesn't say no state shall deny equal protection of the law to anyone who is a member of a objective group-based,
class. You brought up, you said this is in 1983. It's a cause of action provided by Congress. So that's why this is something state and municipal employees can do, but no federal employee could do. 1985 also uses the word person or class of persons, and yet this Court held that 1985-3, that claim, it has to be some group-based animus, not malice directed toward a particular individual.
I don't quite think that I think the Court has already dealt with that in OLEC by affirming essentially a 1983 cause of action based on an individual person's claim. And so that is the relevant precedent here, not the Section 1985 precedent. And now, if we
— Well, maybe because 1985-3 is in a discrimination context, the Court could say 1983, we know the classifications to which Justice Breyer was referring, tax classifications, zoning classifications, but this group of claims we're cutting out.
But the statutory test, its text, Justice Ginsburg, is the same. There's one section 19.
But it's a general statute. It's not a precise statute like Title VII or the Age Discrimination Act. So it's the kind of legislation that seems much more amenable to court interpretation.
I would agree with that. I think it might open a whole can of worms were the court to say that 1983 requires some group-based discrimination outside of this particular context that we're talking about. And so I think —
Well, it certainly opens a can of worms to say that you take every claim against the government, every claim of wrongdoing by the government, and make it an equal protection claim because you say other people were treated properly, and I was treated improperly, therefore I have an equal protection claim.
Except, Justice Ginsburg, we've had this cause of action now for 26 and 27 years in two circuits. We have it in nine. We haven't seen the effect on at will employment, nor more generally on the equal protection clause, opening up that can of worms that you're hypothesizing. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cockfield. Ms. Metcalf?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the Ninth Circuit decision in this case is consistent with this Court's recognition in other constitutional contexts that federal court is simply not the forum in which to second-guess everyday decisions made by public employers. It's also consistent with this Court's recognition, again, in other constitutional contexts, that the rights of public employees simply are not as expansive in a number of ways as those of citizens generally vis-a-vis their public employers. We think that both of those lines of cases come at least in part out of the recognition that public employment decisions, and indeed employment decisions generally, are highly subjective in nature and highly individualistic in nature. And we think really that the Ninth Circuit here has gone no farther than to apply those concepts in the specific context of class of one cases brought in the public employment context.
The Ninth Circuit decision would rule out the case where an employee says, I was the most qualified person for this position by far, but the supervisor took a bribe from a rich uncle to promote somebody else.
Yes.
That would be out.
That would be out as an equal protection claim. There undoubtedly would be potential other avenues of redress.
The scapegoat case, too, would be out.
Yes. Yes, it would. It would under this rationale.
But we have said that there is a constitutional claim if the reason the person was not hired is that the person did not belong to the political party that the hiring person belonged to. The current administration
and
said you can't turn down somebody just because she's a Democrat or a Republican.
That's correct. And our formulation, I think, of the test, Your Honor, is that there should be no such thing as a class of one equal protection claim in the public employment context, with certain exceptions. Those exceptions including, for example, exercise of a fundamental right, membership in a suspect class, perhaps certain other criteria such as the one you mentioned, certain other classifications. But that as a general matter, the broad question that the Ninth Circuit faced, is there, outside of those exceptions, is there such a thing as a class of one public employment?
May I ask, following up on Justice Ginsburg's question, suppose it's not a class of one, but it's a class of two or three, because on two or three occasions they fired somebody because he wouldn't pay the supervisor a bribe. Would that cross the threshold? He had a practice of not getting a little money out of every promotion.
No, Justice Stevens. And again, to be clear, and one
so
reason
not
I
a
keep
class
throwing
of one
up.
You say no or yes to whether there would be a cause of action.
Because this is why I keep using quotes for class of one. Class of one doesn't literally describe the number of plaintiffs, both because in some cases there might be a single plaintiff, but they're alleging discrimination based on membership in class, and because, and OLEC is an example, as the court pointed out in a footnote in OLEC, OLEC could have been described as a class of five. But again, we're talking about discrimination allegedly based on something other than the exceptions that this court has recognized, exercise of a fundamental right, membership in a
— Well, but your, as your friend points out, the constitutional provision says any person. It doesn't say any person who's a member of a particular class or any person who's exercising a fundamental right. It's any person.
Admittedly, Chief Justice Roberts, and I certainly don't think the constitutional text does us any affirmative good, but I don't think it goes as far as petitioner would have it.
Do you think OLEC was correctly decided?
Yes. Yes, we take no issue with OLEC.
And public employment is different just because it's going to be a big problem?
Not because it's going to be a big problem, but because the regulatory context is significantly different, we think, than the employment context. Part of that is the inherently subjective nature of employment decisions. Regulatory decisions are made at arm's length. They're made under
But we're presuming that there is an objective reason for promoting or retaining. The person has a college degree and so forth, but that person is rejected anyway because of dislike.
But again,
that's the hypothetical. Why is that hypothetical case different than OLEC?
You might have an unusual employment case in which an employer had drawn up a list of objective criteria. That's not this case. That's not the average case. In the average case, you might, for example, prefer that someone have a degree.
Then we say that there's a subset of unusual cases where we will allow the cause of action?
No. We offer the subjective nature as a general reason why simply class of one analysis should not apply in this context, period, because the average in the regulatory context probably is a high degree of objectivity, the average in the employment context is a relatively high degree of subjectivity and discretion.
But there are areas outside of employment where there's a lot of discretion. Suppose someone claims that he's repeatedly gotten speeding tickets for going 5 miles over the speed limit by a local police department because of some sort of personal feud with the chief of police. That, I take it, would be a valid claim under OLEC because it's outside of employment?
Because it's regulatory and enforcing law enforcement.
I'm sorry.
I think so.
I'm having trouble hearing both the question and the answer.
As I understand, I don't know if you want me to try to restate the question or if you want to do it.
Well, the question was, don't you run into the same problem of discretion outside of the employment context? For example, a police officer who is alleged to have given someone a ticket or a number of tickets simply because of personal malice as opposed to some sort of uniform policy.
But again, there, I think the norm in law enforcement is a relatively objective standard. Are you, in fact, speeding? Are you, in fact, breaking the traffic laws? Are you, in fact, breaking the law in some other way? Whereas the norm in employment decisions is a much more discretionary, subjective kind of decision. Yes, I may have certain criteria that I would prefer a manager have, but then I'm still going to have to weigh the qualifications and experience of various candidates and ultimately make a relatively subjective decision about who I think is the best candidate for that job, which is why we think the regulatory context and the employment context are significantly different.
Yes, but those are all considerations that would be an adequate defense to a claim. If you had a judgment call to make, you say, I had a judgment call to make, maybe there are good arguments on the other side, but you can't be liable for that kind of decision.
Well, and certainly I'm somewhat perhaps surprised by petitioner's argument today because I understand petitioner's argument to almost concede the point that summary judgment should have been given to the state defendants in this case. Because, in fact, with regard to each of the three employment decisions that are at issue in this case, the state and the defendants did proffer.
We're concerned about the case. Let's just assume, just take it as a hypothetical case where there is an arbitrary and vindictive reason for hiring the employee, and it has nothing to do with race, sex, or other recognized, suspect, or improper categories. And I thought your answer to me was, well, I might make an exception in that case.
No, my answer to you is my answer to you is twofold. If we're simply considering whether, in fact, there can be such a thing as a class of one case in the employment context, our answer is no. If we're past that and the issue was what's the test to apply, our test is as long as there's any conceivable rational basis for the action that the government employer took, the case should be at an end. It should not go to the jury.
Well, isn't that an odd system? I mean, you have, like our time card example, you're going to have litigation over whether she was late for work or was not late for work. And, in fact, that's got nothing to do with the reason she was fired at all. And yet the government puts it up, well, this is a conceivable reason, and then the other side says, no, it's not, and they fight. It just seems so otherworldly. It has nothing to do with the reason at all.
Well, but often the real reason, and this court has made this observation in particular in legislative context, but often the real reason is not necessarily apparent or undisputed. And beyond that, that's simply the test that this court has employed as a general matter in rational basis equal protection cases.
Well, but that's with respect to legislative or regulatory action, where there are important reasons not to inquire into the motives of the legislators. It's not clear to me that same rationale applies here.
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. I would certainly agree that the court has most often, if not always, said that in the legislative context. But petitioner is not really arguing for a different test here. As I understand petitioner's argument, and perhaps I misunderstand it, but petitioner's argument is that this court should apply customary rational basis analysis, and applying such analysis, as long as the government has some conceivable rational basis.
That's
for
not, you know that that's not the position they took in their brief. They said it's not a hypothetical, any conceivable. They said that by qualifying even in the at-will category, government has to articulate a reason rooted in the facts of this case, not a hypothetical. A hypothetical reason is not good enough.
Agreed, Justice Ginsburg. If we don't agree that that would be the test, we think that the court should stick to the customary rational basis test that it's applied in other contexts and say that if there is any conceivable rational basis. But even if you were
to — It seems to me that you want us to write an opinion that say there are some instances where the government can act arbitrarily and unreasonably.
We would ask you to write an opinion, Justice Kennedy, that says that within the public employment context, there are no class of one equal protection claims.
Well, you think the answer is yes. I mean, because the
yes.
Administrative Procedures Act
obviously,
is arbitrary, capricious action. So you're saying the Constitution
yes.
does not constitutionalize all arbitrary,
yes.
capricious behavior
yes.
of the federal government.
And there may well be and probably are going to be other remedies, but not a 14th Amendment remedy.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So the answer is yes. Okay.
And that is because of the existence of other avenues of redress?
Not solely. That I think, is a factor. It's because of, again, this Court's recognition in other contexts that public employees simply are not on the same footing as private citizens generally with regard to their employers, and that federal court is simply not the appropriate forum in which to review the day-to-day decision-making of public employers. And because of recognition of the inherently subjective nature of public employment decisions.
Yeah,
I
understood that the argument. Comment on your opponent's statement that this really has not generated an awful lot of litigation. Do you think he's right or wrong on that?
I think so far as anyone can determine, he's right to date. Obviously, we have some real concern that if this court were to say that there were such a cause of action, that things might change. Beyond that, I think the relatively few number of cases, and in particular the very, very small to date number of successful cases, is an argument against extending class of one equal protection analysis into this context, because there will be an adverse effect on public employer discretion if the court were to extend the analysis. Public employers would have to worry about what happened in this case, that their decisions are subject to later second-guessing in federal court. It may well chill the exercise of public employer discretion. And I think the most common complaint about public employer discretion, it is that it is underutilized, not overutilized, and there would be a real danger that for the price of a very few successful cases, you would chill the exercise of public employer discretion. So we actually think that point is an argument against the extension, not for it. But I would agree that we can't point to any enormous flood of cases to date.
In Oregon, would there be a civil service remedy available to someone in this situation?
There would be admittedly very limited remedies under the civil service laws per se. The decision about whether to advance her as a manager, of who to pick as a manager, was one really solely within the employer's discretion. With respect to the decisions about the layoff and the bumping into someone else's position, she had essentially what were procedural remedies under her collective bargaining agreement, which the union would have had to assert on her behalf if the union had failed to do so, and she had thought the union erred in doing so, she could have brought an action against them. She did have a common law, state law claim in this case, which she brought, one for intentional interference with her employment relationship, which she was successful in, both in the district court and which we did not challenge in the Ninth Circuit. So that state law claim is certainly still a viable claim.
But as far as the federal law claim is concerned, you'd urge us to come out the same way, even if this case came up before the Administrative Procedure Act was passed, right?
Yes. Yes, we would. Although, again, that provides yet an additional remedy to
the Administrative Procedure Act doesn't apply to state procedures. It's a federal act.
Right.
Federal agencies.
As to federal employment, you'd yes. say the same.
Yes.
And you'd say the same if there were no state remedies for employment discrimination by the state?
Yes, we would.
Because the state has a right to employ at will?
Yes, subject to whatever limitations there may be in other affirmative sources of law, such as a collective bargaining agreement or some other state or federal statutory remedy.
Well,
yes.
What exactly is the analytic basis of that? You don't think the Equal Protection Clause applies at all to this situation, where it's just a class of one? Or do you think that the clause is always the claim of violation under the clause is always rebutted automatically? What is the
The former within the context of public employment. We certainly, again, are not taking issue with
Bullock. What authority do you have for us to parse different governmental actions and to say some are subject to the Equal Protection Clause and some are not?
Well, and again, I don't know.
Other than the convenience of the government, it might be more efficient for the government. You want us to say that the government can act arbitrarily with respect to employees.
And again, I don't know that the federal government discusses peremptory challenges, and I'll leave that to them. But again, stepping outside the 14th Amendment context for a moment, this Court certainly, and without explicit textual support, has recognized differences, for example, in the First Amendment rights of public employees vis-a-vis.
Oh, but that's very different, because those cases say that those individuals have no First Amendment rights. In other words, in the public employee context, talking about their official obligations, there is no First Amendment right to do that. I think it's quite a different situation to say there's no equal protection right in government employment.
But maybe I should say again, Your Honor, I think that what we're asking for in this case is the same sort of line drawing, outside textual, atextual line drawing that this Court has done in other contexts, such as the First Amendment context, where it is said that government simply can't impose obligations, restrictions on its public employees that it could not on citizens generally.
And why can't you simply say that they're not being denied equal protection of the law? The law that applies to her and to everybody else employed by the government is that the employment is at will. That's certainly an equal protection. She could be fired at will, and everybody else can be fired at will.
Agreed.
Isn't that an equal protection of the law?
Yes.
Agreed. This wasn't employment at will, right?
Not precisely, but the decision whether or not to promote effectively might as well have been at will, in the sense that that was a decision subject solely to the discretion of the employer. So in a sense, it's analogous. I wouldn't say that it is precisely at will with respect to any of these decisions. And again, because she had only limited rights under the collective bargaining agreement, outside of those limited rights, the employer really had full discretion as to what decision it would make. So I think there's an analogy to at will.
What proportion of your workforce is really hired at will? Aren't they all got some kind of protections under your statutes? And
as a matter of fact, none of the assistant attorneys general, including me, have any protection. Most state employees have some kind of collective. I'm arguing against myself in this case. Most employees in the state of Oregon have some kind of collective bargaining protection. So at will is the exception, not the rule.
Don't you have some kind of civil service system too?
Not precisely. It's much more a matter of collective bargaining, but it amounts to much the same thing in the end.
So people who are employed at will are the exception rather than the rule.
Absolutely. I would readily concede that fact. If the court gets to the second part of the case and the question becomes what sort of test, assuming that the court finds a class of one analysis should apply in this context, and the question becomes what's the test, really all the state is asking for here is an application of a customary rational basis test in which if any conceivable rational basis can be offered by the government, the case should be in an end. That position was raised below by the state defendants, who raised the point both in their summary judgment motion and in their trial memo, and urged the district court to take this case away from the jury on that basis, and the district court refused to do
what,
so.
What do you say to the argument that the conceivable basis test is appropriate when we're judging legislation because we don't know what goes through the minds of individual legislators, whereas these kinds of decisions, employment decisions, are in fact very specific state of mind kind of decisions, and therefore the equal protection standard ought to take that into consideration and look to the specific reasons?
I think the difference is not that great. I think admittedly the actual rationale is harder to discern in legislative cases, in part because you have so many decision makers. But here, for example, is similar because the decision makers might have had a number and probably did have a number of elements in mind from dislike to a preference for a certain kind of background. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Metcalf. Ms. Black.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, there are two types of class of one claims that should not be recognized in the public employment context. The first is a claim of residual ill will or bad motive simpliciter, and the second is a simple demand for a rational basis for an adverse personnel decision. The problem with those claims is that they would constitutionalize routine employee grievances and impose a for-cause requirement on public employers, notwithstanding the long tradition of at-will public employment.
And the reason that we didn't say that same thing in OLEC is because in the taxation area or the easement area, we simply don't have the great number of cases, and also because animus is more easily established?
It's similar. In the regulatory context, a personality conflict is not a legitimate basis for adversely treating a citizen. But a personality conflict between a supervisor and a subordinate is generally, if not always, a legitimate basis for adversely treating an employee.
I wondered if I was right, but I thought that looking back, that there's something about zoning and taxation where it normally is a legislative rulemaking activity, and that perhaps you would apply all these things that you're talking about where even if it is employment, where what the employer is doing or anyone else is doing is creating rules, is classifying, and not a made-up classification like you put me and one other fired person in the fired person category. I don't mean that.
Well,
I mean like taxation and zoning and legislation. Is there anything to that?
There is some support in the case law, but what I think your concurring opinion was trying to do was help local and state governments. And it's one thing to say the mayor denied my building permit and I'm going to make the employee allege animus, and that might be difficult to do. But for someone in the mayor's staff, it's not that difficult to allege animus on the part of your supervisor. Employment frictions are inherent in the workplace, and perceptions of unfair treatment readily arise by an employee who thinks he or she was unfairly treated.
Well, I agree with all that, but so the Equal Protection Clause doesn't apply?
Sure it applies. It just doesn't give you a right to collect what this plaintiff did, punitive and compensatory damages based on residual ill will. She ran an equal protection claim on race, gender, national origin, sex. She had a statutory claim for opposing unlawful conduct under Title VII. The jury rejected all that and imposed punitive damages, and it went to the jury. A legal question that has always been decided by this court and the court about whether there was a rational basis or whether instead it was solely based on vindictive, arbitrary, or malicious reasons went to the jury, and there was no allegation of any type of —
So you think the Equal Protection Clause applies?
Yes.
But in every case of public employment, what?
No, if you have a membership in an identifiable group classification as opposed to purely subjective and individualized criteria. Here her class was, I was a thorn in my supervisor's side. That's not a class. And if it is a class, you would lose because you would always have a rational
basis. But the Equal Protection Clause doesn't talk about classes. It talks about any person.
That's correct. And in the First Amendment, and that's a different amendment, but in the 14th Amendment, there's the Batson context. It's just like in the Batson context, the high cost of litigating every single claim to try to ferret out what would truly be an irrational decision is not worth the cost when there's such an overwhelming likelihood that a truly irrational decision would already be prohibited by some other contract or statutory source.
It doesn't talk about equal protection, actually. It talks about equal protection of the law. And if the law in the government employment context is that you can be dismissed at will or for a number of reasons, so long as everybody's subject to that same law, there would seem to be no discrimination in the law.
Well, we're not relying on the text of the Equal
Protection. Oh, don't rely on the text, certainly.
What we're relying on is two principles. And there's just a longstanding principle that the Constitution is not the appropriate form to resolve routine employment disputes.
What
and there's
do
also
you do, Ms. Blatt, with the two cases that I raised, Ms. Medka? That is the bribe case and the scapegoat case. They're out, too, under if public employment is taken out from this class of one, those two cases would go as well.
Right. Well, one is criminal conduct. And on the scapegoat case, I actually don't think that's such a bad thing. One can recharacterize scapegoating as public accountability. And their side would allow federal courts and state courts to second-guess local employment's response to a public crisis. So if there's a school board or some tragic accident in the city and a group of employees are fired, their side would give a constitutional claim for punitive and compensatory damages based on a finding of ill will. And although the other side comes up here and tells a story about traditional rational basis, in this case, it was submitted to the jury about whether there was a rational basis or whether whatever articulated basis was a mere pretext. It was treated basically like a sex, gender, a race claim, and not a rational basis claim. It should have never gone to the jury. It's not a fact question whether there's a rational basis.
Can we meet
if you have objection? A mixed motive case, both ill will and some reason she also was late to work, you would win that case.
Well,
if you have one good reason and one bad reason, the bad reason doesn't trump the good reason.
That's right. In a mixed motive constitutional case involving a fundamental right, it's a fact question for the jury. In a rational basis case, it would be a question for the court whether there's a conceivable rational basis.
But a public employee applies for a 30-foot easement that he's entitled to and doesn't receive it. And the mayor says, and by the way, I don't like you, so you're fired. A, you don't get the easement. B, you're fired. Why do we treat the cases differently, other than the floodgate argument, et cetera?
Well, if the mayor doesn't give the employee a grievance, in her capacity as a citizen, she has a suit under OLEC. But in her termination claim, she, unless she can allege membership in an identifiable class, she doesn't have an equal protection right to be free from just pure arbitrariness.
That not states your conclusion. I want to know why that is.
Why? Because personality conflicts have no role in the regulatory context, and they generally, if not always, are the legitimate basis for a personnel decision. It's just that the they say this example of, well, employer doesn't like you, that's sufficient. But the other side never tells you how far they would take that. Is it because the conflict arose in the workplace? Is it because it arose from their neighborhood? Is it because it arose from the high school debate team or law review or the cheerleading squad, and that's why the person wasn't hired? And we would have courts having to, go judge by judge or court by court, and in their case, jury by jury, for these kinds of decisions. And these shouldn't be constitutional cases. These are more appropriately resolved under merit service protection laws and collective bargaining agreements.
Would it meet your concern if we held, number one, yes, there may be a class of one claim in the public employment context, but any reason that would be a lawful reason for discharge under the at-will rule is a reason that would satisfy the test, and therefore it would be the real outlier that would ever get to the jury.
Well, in the at-will context, if an employer says you're fired and gives no reason, that's legitimate. But in their case, at least by the time a lawyer is hired and the case goes to court, the state has to articulate a basis that could be second-guessed. If you are going to apply class of one and write a very broad opinion saying almost anything goes in the employment context, that's certainly preferable than having this go to juries based on pretext and bad motive, which is what happened in this case. But I still think it would impose a for-cause requirement that's inconsistent with your due process cases, which presuppose that the personnel entitlement must spring from someplace other than the Constitution.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I wasn't trying a trick question, but let me be explicit about this. If we adopted the rule that said anything that goes under the at-will rule goes under equal protection class of one, would there be anything left?
No.
Okay.
Yeah,
so the reason is if we adopted that rule, you'd win across the board.
Yes. Yes. Unless you leave, right, there's no point. I mean, the at-will rule is that no reason be given or it could be a bad reason. And if there's any concern about the line drawing, I would urge you just to look at the verdict form in this case. All that was submitted to the jury after there was the rejection of the national origin, the gender, the race, the color, the retaliation for reporting sexual harassment was just a simple case of without any rational basis and solely for arbitrary, vindictive, and malicious reasons.
So we should cite there's no constitutional right to be a policeman. We can revive that.
Well, no. I mean, there are lots of constitutional limits on public employment. What we're talking about is where you've reduced at-will to a null set and there's any claim for arbitrary conduct. I mean, we would allow, under our theory, any claim that is not just a residual ill will or bad motive, a state's a valid equal protection case. And there's, many, many statutory protections as well.
Thank you, Ms. Blatt. Ms. Cotillo, 4 minutes remaining.
The Ninth Circuit in this case, Your Honors, cut out all claims, conceivable or otherwise, and that is contrary to the text of the Equal Protection Clause in this Court's precedent.
Do you agree with me that if we adopted a rule that says anything that goes for at-will employment goes for one-person class equal protection, that in effect would eliminate any cause of action?
It would, Justice Souter, under the formal rule, that is, no reason alone is sufficient. That, of course, as a practical matter, is not the way at-will works anymore. Anymore because of the panoply of rules, Title VII and otherwise, that force employers to articulate rationales when they terminate at-will employees. So as a practical matter, the no-reason firing doesn't exist anymore because those at-will employees who are going to sue are going to sue anyway.
You just keep stressing the text of the Equal Protection Clause. Don't you think it's rather late in the day to be arguing that the Equal Protection Clause should be read with that kind of literalness?
They don't. That is that this Court has consistently held that the text of the Equal Protection Clause encompasses personal claims.
Well, it talks about laws, but it extends to situations where the unequal treatment is not stemming from the law, but from executive or administrative action, doesn't it?
That's quite right, Justice Alito, and it has since 1879, this Court has said.
Many other examples, are there not, of situations where it's been held to apply that might not fall within the literal language of the clause?
I'm not sure I got that. I'm sorry.
You think it applies, that it, in all other respects it's read literally?
I'm not sure if in all other respects it is, but with respect to the relevant questions here, that is, does the clause apply to individual agency actions? This Court has held so in 1879 in Missouri versus Lewis and has held so consistently ever since. So in this case, the government put forth one rationale, which was an objective one, Wheat, and disclaimed all the others, the subjective ones. And we do think that those subjective rationales, employment is different, and will almost always be a rational basis. In this case, they disclaimed all those other ones. So here, the government is using its power, its raw power, purely for its own personal ends, and that is contrary to the whole notion of why employment should be different, which is government efficiency.
What is your answer to their Batson analysis?
That it, Batson, I think, supports exactly what we're saying, which is this Court has said we don't review on rational basis actions by a prosecutor that are motivated, strikes that are motivated by the trial, that are for a good trial. But if the rationale of the prosecutor is I don't like the disabled person, or I don't like.
Oh, but you're adding the class aspect. I mean, if the rationale of the prosecutor is I don't like this person. Under Batson, you don't get to bring an equal protection challenge to that.
I don't quite think that this Court's confronted that specific issue about whether it's an individual class of one juror case. But the language of Batson says that we don't — that this Court won't review on rational basis a claim when it's related to the government's motivation there to have a fair trial, a good trial.
I thought you don't — if you have a peremptory challenge, it means that you can't — challenge on any basis other than the group the groups that Batson has recognized. But you said you could challenge a peremptory, the exercise of peremptory challenge, if it's unrelated to the selection of an impartial jury. Well, I thought that a peremptory outside of the class cases is matter of the prosecutor or the defense attorney don't like this juror.
Justice Ginsburg, the language in Batson and JEB was qualified by saying so long it was related to the task at hand. And the Seventh Circuit and indeed the D.C. Circuit last year referred to that language and talked about an exemption if the prosecutor's motive was personal, as it is in this case.
Has there ever been a challenge to the exercise of peremptory challenge on the ground that the challenge was unrelated to the selection of an impartial jury?
In the Seventh Circuit decision, the Court said that this would state a cause of action. That was after this Court's decision in JEB. Yes.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.